Gonna hold now 11, this is the House Labor and Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum here, Representative Vice Chair Joe Green, Representative Mulder, Representative Sitton, Representative Porter, myself, Representative Hudson, Chair of this committee. Today we're going to hear House Bill 459, Liquidated Damages. And then following that, we're going to hear for the second time House Bill 403, Auto Liability Insurance. We had heard that once before. The other measure that was listed to be heard today is House Bill 309. This bill, we've been asked by the prime sponsor to hold it over until next time we convene here because he had wanted to have a professional testimony, and they weren't available today. So with that, and for the record, also we've been joined by Representative Williams. So I think we were only missing one member here. And Representative Mulder, would you like to introduce the committee to this bill, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we are taking up HB 459 first.
Yes, we are.
I appreciate the committee scheduling HB 459. In a nutshell, what 459 attempts to do is correct a provision of Alaska statute which changed the wage and hour wording, which up to a couple years ago was working, but an interpretation by the court kind of made a big problem in relation to what's called liquidated damages. In a nutshell, what liquidated damages are is the provision where you have unpaid or underpaid overtime compensation, which is disputed. And liquidated damages stipulates that the award is double what was underpaid or not paid. That's liquidated damages. That is the assessment. It's double the award. That liquidated damages is goes beyond what federal mandate or federal wage and hour law requires. And in the past, it was provided or interpreted, our statutes were interpreted to say that if there was a dispute about unpaid or underpaid overtime, that it could be resolved by either Department of Labor or it could be resolved administratively. That is to say, between the individual making the claim and the employer, it could be that could be resolved administratively out of court for less than liquidated damages. In other words, less than two times the award. But once it hit the court, once it did go to court, if it could not be resolved outside of court, it was automatically, if the award was to be made, it was liquidated damages. So what this... Then the case called Kinney Shoe came along. And Kinney Shoe, the court interpreted statute to be different than what was being done at that point in time. It said that no settlement can be made out of court for less than liquidated damages, than less than double the disputed claim, which was not really the intent of the legislation when it was originally passed. What this legislation does is attempt to correct that process, whereby it allows the Department of Labor or through administrative action the award to be interpreted or to be awarded for an agreed amount. I mean, in other words, both parties would agree to it for less than liquidated damages. That, in a nutshell, is what the bill does. I believe there is an attorney online by the name of Perry Grover who... will be able to expound on what I've said and also answer specific questions pertaining to the bill.
All right, thank you, Representative Mulder. For the committee's interest, we do have a sectional summary by Terry Kramer, our legislative counsel, some backup letters, and new to me at any rate is the February 21st position paper by Department of Labor. Contact R.B. Williams. And so I don't know if the committee has had an opportunity to review that, but Eldon, I presume at any rate that someone will speak to the at least two concerns that were expressed in the Department of Labor's position paper, and that would be if the committee wants to refer to it at the bottom of the position paper, which is just underneath the fiscal note and the bill itself. On the very last paragraph of that page, it indicates that the Department of Labor supports but proposes to amend House Bill number 459 to define good faith to include affirmative action taken by the employer to comply with state law. And then on the second page of the position paper, in addition, the last paragraph would propose that the inclusion of Section 4 be reconsidered. Section 4 is the date, let's see here, application of the act, and it speaks to the effective date of the act and, right, and some of the provisions in that.
The retroactivity provision. First, I'll talk to the
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first issue deals with the interpretation of good faith. In other words, the settlements being reached and liquidated damages is assessed basically as a punitive action, saying that you've been trying to withhold money. And there are the employers, by and large, the employers did not know that they were, that this person was being denied their overtime. They weren't trying to cheat them out of it. It was in good faith the fact that for one reason or another it didn't get done. It was not paid. And basically, there is concern about how do you interpret good faith. That is to say that I wasn't intentionally going out there as an employer trying to harm that employee not paying the overtime. And in this sense, our language mirrors that of the Federal Labor Standards Act, which states, if the employer shows to the satisfaction of the court that the act or omission giving rise to such action was in good faith, and that he had reasonable grounds for believing his act or omission was not in violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the court may, in its sound discretion, award no liquidated damages or award any amount thereof not to exceed the amount specified. So the reason that we haven't given more specific language at this point in time is, as Perry will tell you, in terms of interpreting good faith, it is felt that there is pre-existing statute or pre-existing law cases which are or have already determined what good faith is, that if we would throw in our own definition, it may confuse or cloud the water further than what it is right now, make it more murky, or even create a different standard to which Alaska is held as opposed to the federal standard. So, and I believe Perry will talk to that. The other question in relation to retroactivity, that was a provision that was put in to make a level playing field from before pre-Kinney to post-pre-Kinney. That is to say that it was never the intent to be what this bill is addressing is overly punitive. You know, that we were going to allow for administrative actions and not mandate liquidated damages automatically and allow for administrative or even for the court to administer less than liquidated damages. That was the spirit of or the intent of why it was done the way it was done. But I do think Perry will much more adequately address those questions.
Perry Grover, okay. Representative Green, did you?
No, why don't we wait?
I want to hear him first. Question. All right, we'll take Mr. Perry Grover in Nome. Are you there, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. This is Perry Grover in Nome.
Go ahead and if you would, just give us your name and affiliation, and we'd like to hear your testimony on the bill.
Thank you very much. And by the way, it's a beautiful sunny day here in Nome. I'm glad to be calling you from Nome. I strongly support House Bill 459. I am an attorney from Anchorage, and I practiced law approximately a little less than 14 years in Alaska, mostly in labor relations and employment matters. I primarily represent employers, but I also represent neutral fact-finding bodies such as the Anchorage Municipal Employee Relations Board and other neutral agencies of that type on the municipal or borough level. The one thing I have noticed over the years about Alaska, about the Alaska Wage and Hour Act, is that while it is patterned after the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, and includes, of course, the requirements for overtime and the possibility of liquidated damages if you don't pay overtime or minimum wages, one of the things that struck me is that Alaska has, for years, made liquidated damages mandatory, where federal law and the law of most other states that I'm familiar with allows a very narrow exception, and I'm sincere in that. I do mean it's a narrow exception. And that exception is where the employer can show that it acted in good faith and reasonably believed that the position it thought was not subject to overtime, when it had a reasonable basis and honestly believed that, if it's nevertheless shown to be wrong in court or an action brought by the commissioner, that the court would then have discretion not to award liquidated damages. Federal law has allowed that for years, and the law of other states that I'm familiar with, such as California, Oregon, allows that. But Alaska hasn't, and I've wondered for years why Alaska has a more harsh statute. And that was really brought home in the Kinney decision, I believe, in 1991, where the Alaska Supreme Court said our statute means no ifs, ands, and buts, and liquidated damages must be awarded in every case, and there can be no settlements, and even if there were, they would have to be liquidated damages. By that, I mean no private settlements. And I'm not speaking against liquidated damages. There are many appropriate cases where an employer has wrongfully withheld overtime pay and should be assessed liquidated damages. But in my experience, there are in Alaska employers that do meet, that would meet the federal standard and the standard in other states, which is namely, they honestly thought the employee was not subject to overtime, and they had a reasonable basis for believing that. They talked to somebody with the Department of Labor. They talked to an attorney. They talked to an accountant. They reviewed Department of Labor opinion letters and had a reasonable basis for believing that the person was not subject to overtime. Today, in Alaska, none of that makes any difference. And I literally have had clients who have obtained the advice of the Alaska Department of Labor only to, a couple years later in court, find out that the facts weren't quite as they thought, and they're assessed overtime pay and liquidated damages. So this bill, the primary thrust of this bill, is really and truly corrective. It just brings, it would bring Alaska back into the mainstream with the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act and with the law in other states that I'm familiar with. It will leave liquidated damages as a penalty available in court and to the Commissioner of Labor, but it will allow employers a very narrow exception, which is, if they can show they act in good faith, and that means honestly, they honestly believed that the person was not entitled to overtime pay, and they had a reasonable basis for that belief, that then the court would not necessarily have to award liquidated damages. I don't think that's asking an awful lot, but that's really all that's in Section 3D of this bill does. If I could comment, may I comment on Section 3E and F?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Section 3E was initially proposed by the commissioner, because what happened in the Kinney Shoe case is prior to Kinney Shoe, the Commissioner of Labor on the cases that his agency handled would settle overtime cases and sometimes would waive liquidated damages. And they felt, and I had a number of cases with them where in some cases they would waive liquidated damages, in other cases they wouldn't. But they have the administrative discretion to make that decision. After Kinney Shoes, the courts told them, no, you don't. And since then, it has been impossible to settle any case with the Alaska Department of Labor without doubling the damages. That has made the settlements both more expensive and more difficult. And the commissioner, my understanding is, requested that the language in subsection 3E be added, because that would take him back to the position prior to Kinney Shoes and would give him the discretion to waive liquidated damages or not. And I think that's fine. I have no objection to that. I felt that the system the Commissioner of Labor was administering prior to Kinney Shoes was fine. and it was that the commissioner's people were professional, and they settled cases where it made sense, and they litigated cases where the employer was recalcitrant and deserved it. So I have no objection to subsection E. I think it's a good improvement, but it'll benefit the commissioner primarily. Subsection F is also in response to Kenny Shoes, and I think sometimes, I'm going to give the Supreme Court the benefit of the doubt, I think sometimes they write decisions in language perhaps broader than what they really intended. But if you look at the Kenny Shoes case, they actually say the private settlements of these wage and error cases are void. Not that they're voidable or that they can be attacked, but they simply said they're void. Well, that, as a practical matter, makes it impossible for private litigants to settle the cases, even where the parties want to. And to give you an idea of how extreme this has become, since Kenny Shoes, in my own office, I'm aware of a number of cases where an employee filed or presented a claim, either through the Department of Labor or directly to the employer through an attorney, and we agreed to settle the claim, but we didn't think the settlement would hold up if there was any challenge because of Kenny Shoe, and we actually had to ask the claimant, please sue us, file a lawsuit so we can put it before a court and get the settlement blessed. And it seems to me that's really bad public policy for a state such as Alaska to encourage litigation where the parties are willing to settle and have reached a reasonable settlement and they're comfortable with it. So subsection F simply undoes that part of Kenny Shoe where the court said that private settlements are void, and it allows private settlements to go forward. If you would like, Mr. Chairman, I'd also be happy to respond to the two concerns raised by the Department of Labor.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. First, the Department of Labor, as I understand, has some concerns about the definition of good faith. It was our intention in proposing this corrective measure that the state of Alaska use the same standards the federal government has been using and other states have been using for years. The terms good faith and reasonable grounds come right out of 29 U.S. Code Section 260. And there are maybe 50 or 60 federal and state cases reported. If you look at the annotated decisions, you will see those cases reported. There are also federal regulations that deal with what those words mean. My concern about Alaska attempting to define those terms is that if we use any different language than the feds and the other states have used and the courts have used, I think that will just be an inducement to attorneys to litigate the question all the way up to the Supreme Court with the argument that, well, if our legislature has used different language, then it must mean something different than what the federal law provides and the decisions in other states have held under the same standards. What I would recommend to the Department of Labor is the Department of Labor has power right now under the Alaska Wage and Hour Act to adopt regulations which interpret provisions such as this. And the Department of Labor, if it's concerned about the good faith standard, could simply say in their own regulations that we agree or disagree with the federal standards. I hope they would agree with the federal standards. And I would simply point out to this body that there are numerous cross-references in Alaska labor regulations to the corresponding federal regulations which are incorporated verbatim by the Department of Labor. So I think that the Department of Labor can take care of this problem by adopting a regulation. I agree with them in principle that to meet the good faith and fair, the good faith and reasonable ground standard, an employer must take some affirmative act, because reasonable ground means you have to have done something like look at the job position, talk to an attorney, talk to somebody at the Department of Labor, obtain Department of Labor opinions as to whether the position is exempt or not. I mean, you have to do something affirmative like that. But the problem with us building into statute a standard that is different than what you see under federal law is that I think we're just inviting litigation, whereas if you make it clear in the legislative history of this bill that we're interested in simply in bringing Alaska in line with the federal standards and those court decisions, there's a wide body of precedents out there defining what reasonable grounds and good faith are, and it's a hard standard to meet, but those cases are already there, and Alaska courts can rely on that. And if the Department of Labor is really concerned, they can simply say in their regulation, and we agree, those are the standards, those federal standards, and they should be applied in complying with this statute. So I think the Department of Labor has it within their own power to make sure that there's no misunderstanding about what good faith and reasonable grounds means. As to the last section, as to the effective date of the Act, the reason it's broken into two operative provisions is this. My understanding is the Commissioner of Labor wished his section 3E, to become effective on the effective date of the Act. And that was their preference, and certainly we have no objection to that. Section 3E is their proposal, and if they want it effective on the effective date of the Act, that's fine. The other provisions really hark back to federal law, which has been in existence for years and years and years. And our feeling is that it's rather arbitrary to say only those cases filed after the effective date of the Act will be governed by these standards, which have been out there in the federal sector and other states for years and years and years. It makes more sense simply to say if the case is still open, in other words, if it hasn't gone to trial, if it hasn't gone to final judgment, then the court may apply this standard that the legislature has corrected. It's not a matter of having adopted a brand new standard or simply correcting it, and I don't see any reason why the court shouldn't be able to pick that up and employ it in rendering a judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Perry. Any questions of the committee? Representative Green?
Just for my edification, if I might, the way page 1, item C says that reasonable attorney's fees to be determined according to court rule, what does that mean?
In Alaska, that means Civil Rule 82. Alaska is unique in among all other 50 states in having a Civil Rule 82 where the prevailing party in civil litigation recovers at least partial attorney's fees as a matter of right. Most other states do not have that sort of provision. And so when the reference to court rule, I'm sure, means Civil Rule 82.
All right, thank you. Representative Mulder?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green. Joe, what Section 2, Subsection C pertains to is the fact that currently I believe that if you are taken to court, if you're the employer, you're taken to court for liquidated damages and you prevail, the court determines that you prevail, you are not allowed currently the opportunity to recover any of your attorney's fees. Is that correct? Perry?
Yes, that is. The way the bill reads now, only the plaintiff can recover attorney's fees. In other words, it's half of Civil Rule 82. Civil Rule 82, in any other civil case, allows the prevailing party, whether that's the plaintiff or defendant, to recover at least partial attorney's fees. It's usually not full attorney's fees. But in other words, if you've been hauled into court and have a meritorious defense, today under the law, you'd have to eat all of your attorney's fees. If this bill is enacted and you have a meritorious defense and the defendant wins, the defendant would be in a position, as in other civil cases, to recover at least partial attorney's fees from the plaintiff.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions here? All right. Thank you. Mr. Grover, we'll have some other testimony here at the table. And are you able to hang on with us for a little longer here?
Yes, I can for another 15 minutes or so, but I'd certainly be happy to listen in.
All right, fine. Then we'll move next, I think, to Bruce Weirich. Bruce, would you like to come up and testify, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I have some materials to hand out.
Sure.
Staff. The materials I'm handing out, one thing it includes is a copy of the Kinney Shoe case, so you can see when people talk about Kinney Shoe, you know what we're talking about. I've also handed out a proposed amendment to Section 3, amending D and E. And for the record, my name is Bruce Weirich. I'm with Faulkner Banfield and work with a number of employees around the state and have some concerns about HB 459. One reason Alaska has the kind of wage and hour law it does is because what other state is like Alaska? Alaska has a huge seasonal workforce. We have people and companies that come in from outside to do business here seasonally. And many companies that come in seasonally from outside don't feel the need to pay quite so much attention to our laws as those companies that work here. So it puts those companies that work here and live here and hire local workers and the same workers for outside as outside companies at a competitive disadvantage if they have to follow the law and the outside companies don't. The wage and hour laws were intended to be strictly enforced, and as the Supreme Court says in Kinishu's case, to be very, very punitive in nature if they aren't followed. And that is to wield a significant club over people's heads if they don't pay the wage that they say they're supposed to pay. So there has been some concerns about the Department of Labor not being involved here. So what this amendment does is it allows the commissioner or the Department of Labor to be involved in front, at the front end of an issue. So if an employer isn't going to pay a wage and hour or a wage and hour agreed to or required to, they can work out in advance some payment plan under D, sign an agreement, the department passes off on it, and it avoids all this litigation that people are talking about. For example, what employer worth his salt isn't going to pay a wage lower than what they have to and then come in and say later on, oh, I did it in good faith. That of course they're going to say that. I mean, so to say it's going to do away with litigation is you're just going to litigate a different issue, what's good faith and what's not. So I don't think that really solves the problem. I think rather than having the Department of Labor involved at the end, you want them involved at the beginning. And that's what this amendment would do, indeed. And also, this comment about federal law, under federal labor law, 29 U.S.C., and this is provided in the analysis at page 2, section 216C, they do give the Secretary of Labor to supervise payments and settlements. But 459 does not track the federal language, but goes well beyond it, authorizing settlements directly between the employer and the employee without the protection or safeguard of any supervision. And that's what the Supreme Court in Kenny, and that's what the wage and hour laws require, is that you have somebody supervise. And the reason for that is, just take a practical example. If an employer comes up to an employee and says, look, we paid you less than we owed you, and now we're willing to do right by you, here's the money we were supposed to pay you. What employee's going to say? Heck with you, I want what I'm due under liquidated damages. You didn't pay me, my family suffered, I was supposed to be paid what I was owed, and now you're offering me to pay just what I was supposed to be paid rather than some penalty. It requires a court or a third party to supervise that payment because an employee isn't going to say, no, I'm not, because they have a fear of losing their job or something like that. So that's why Alaska has a strong wage and hour law. Anyway, the comments are contained in the summary we've attached.
Bruce, can you explain C, your section C, amendment C?
The amendment only has D and E.
Or D and E, I'm sorry, yeah. Mm. I got my glasses on, too.
Well, under E. D, or excuse me, E, if you look at...
the two go together?
Yes. Okay. Section E, this is what would track federal law, and page 2 of the analysis explains that by revising 459 to track the federal language authorizing the commissioner to supervise settlements, what you do is you allow this without having to involve litigation and lawyers. You front-end the Department of Labor to supervise before it happens rather than after the fact, and then so you don't completely throw them out of the way, and you allow this settlement to occur anyway.
Does that involve more action by the Department of Labor than they currently have?
Well, one thing that the current wage and hour laws do is it provides a significant incentive to an employee to go out there and try and recover. And by having that incentive, you save on administrative costs by instead of having to hire a bunch of Department of Labor employees to go out and supervise everybody's wage and hour agreements. So the intent of the statute, by giving a liquidated damage provision, makes it lucrative for employees to recover salaries they were owed because it gives that liquidated damages provisions, and that's why lawyers get involved, frankly.
Any questions of the committee?
Thank you.
Let's see. Staff, I don't have anybody else signed up to testify.
Is it Al Parrish somewhere?
Mr. Andrews?
Mr. Parrish, on the... Is Al Parrish, we are understanding that you wish to testify. Are you on the line anywhere?
Or not.
If you're not there, don't say anything. Is there anyone here? Roop, are you going to come forward? And
yes.
Please come forward. Roop Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roop Andrews. I'm a volunteer for the American Association of Retired Persons. My testimony is very brief today. We are concerned about House Bill 459, and in the respect that we would like to see supervision by the commissioner or whoever, particularly in regards to senior citizens 65 plus. We think that they are particularly vulnerable to abuse by employers, and a continuation of supervision would be more to our liking, and we would like to see that continue, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Roop, do they have, are there any supervision, any current provisions in law, in our law at any rate, to treat them with this kind of care at the present time?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that. I don't know.
Bruce, there isn't any. All right. All right, thank you. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perry, are you in line still?
Yes, I am.
Have you been able to pick up what's been offered as a proposed amendment?
I don't know the language, but I heard the points made. I can respond to those if you're interested.
Yes, please.
Thank you. First, I believe it's Bruce Weirich from Faulkner Banfield who spoke. I do disagree with him, and I'll give you an example of why. And gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, please don't think that as an attorney I'm asking for any special consideration. No one loves attorneys in this day and age, and that's fine. But let me give you an example of the problem we have here. There is a debate raging right now in Alaska whether legal assistants are professional employees and exempt from overtime or not. My law firm looked at it years and years ago and decided, no, we don't think they are. So we treat all of our legal assistants as hourly employees, and we pay them overtime because we were concerned about the Alaska laws and complying with them, and have done so. I've also found, however, that the great majority of Alaska law firms treat their legal assistants as exempt professionals and don't pay them overtime. I don't know about the Faulkner Banfield firm, but I wouldn't be surprised if they treated them as exempt professionals. I just don't know. The problem, and it's a good faith argument, and right now the Department of Labor is litigating that issue with an Anchorage law firm. I'm aware of that. The point I'm making here is even homegrown businesses can be wrong about whether they're required to pay a certain employee overtime or not. They can have looked at the issue. They can have a good faith disagreement with the Department of Labor. They can have a reasonable basis for their position. And in the particular case I'm thinking about that is pending in court in Anchorage, I know for a fact that the law firm really thinks that their legal assistant is an exempt professional employee, and that's the way 9 out of 10 of the legal assistants they've had see it also. But under Alaska law, if that homegrown law firm is proven wrong, liquidated damages automatically will be doubled. And Mr. Weirich made the point that why let out-of-state businesses off the hook? I represent some out-of-state businesses, but the majority of my clients, the majority of my firm's clients are homegrown, and that's where the problem has been, is that homegrown firms, if they're wrong, get hammered automatically, even if they have a good faith basis for believing that overtime was not owed. The other point that Mr. Weirich made, I'd like to respond to, is that I think he was objecting to Section 3F, allowing private settlements. And I find that puzzling because in the employment law area, there are all sorts of cases. There are employment discrimination cases, there are whistleblower cases, there are wrongful termination cases. Those cases involve not only pay, but they involve emotional distress and punitive damages claims. And for years and years and years, it's been possible to privately settle those cases. In fact, we can settle them today. And yet, in this one area, people say, well, no, we can't allow private settlements. Employers will take advantage of employees if we allow private settlements here. Well, if that's true here, then you shouldn't be allowing private settlements of EEO cases, of wrongful termination cases, and whistleblower cases. And, of course, if you adopt that policy, you're going to clog the courts with more employment law cases than you can imagine. It may be fine for those of us who practice in the area, but I don't think it's good public policy. And what I'm saying is that these cases can be settled without taking advantage of employees. And most employees that have any kind of a claim will either go to the Department of Labor and be represented at no cost, or if they have a substantial claim, they'll go to an attorney, and he or she will squeeze the maximum amount of money out of it. That has been my experience. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I've addressed that, and I've said that everyone probably agrees the commissioner should be given the authority to settle cases without court approval. And I've incorporated, or we've incorporated that into Section E, where the commissioner can inject, allow the parties to come together, settle the differences, and no court approval is allowed. I think everybody agrees you shouldn't have to inject, like the witness said, sue us. That's unreasonable.
Mr. Grover, perhaps you don't have the copy of the two amended subsections that the committee has here that were presented by Mr. Wyrick. It would add a D and a E, and I guess that we're faxing it up now, so you should have that. Perhaps you can take a look at that and see if that changes your testimony or if you feel that that is reasonable. Have you got
Thank you. The aide here went to the fax machine to pick that up.
All right, fine.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I mean, I'm just chatting with Bruce.
Representative Mulder.
In chatting with Bruce, F is the guts of the bill. It allows for decisions to be made outside of, you know, for administrative actions to occur. And
existing F.
Yes, existing F. Under the proposed amendment, F would be deleted. And it's to say that, you know, well, Eldon, because you're not smart enough to think on your own, you can't settle things out of court. And I disagree with that. This is all this is doing by deleting F, it's a greater employment act for attorneys. And I disagree with that. They're not going to get any more money in the end. The injured person, the injured claimant, isn't going to get any more in the end. They're just going to have to sue for more to pay for their attorney. That's the bottom line.
I'm curious, Representative Mulder, where do you see the deletion of F?
In the amendment.
Mr. Wyrick's proposed amendment to section for Section 3, it's amending. All they're doing is deleting F, along with rewording some of the parts of D and E.
Reworded a little bit. Mm-hmm. They just excluded it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Porter?
Speaking to the amendment, we've heard the term punitive damages. The Department of Law even used it in the first line of their analysis. Having put this committee through hours and hours of tort reform, we are experts in what punitive damages means. And it means the establishment of gross negligence or intentional violation. That's the standard that in which punitive damages are applied generally. In this case, actually, punitive damages are applied by law, the doubling of the amount due, and the employer, we're saying, has to try to establish why he shouldn't have punitive damages. I think we've got the employer in the box far enough to then say that he doesn't have a right to try to work out these problems with an employee, but has to go sit down under the supervision of the Department of Law and have more impact on the Department of Law when we're trying to reduce that. I don't think is equitable, and I wouldn't support the amendment.
Brian, how about the testimony that we'd received from Rupe Andrews about, and perhaps you might speak to that as well, Mr. Wyrick, and I might ask Mr. Perry as well, or Mr. Grover. Rupe Andrews, speaking for the AARP, was asking for or expressing some concern, if I'm right, about vulnerability of people over the age of 65. I don't totally agree with you, Rube, because I'm getting there pretty close to myself. And I don't have to have anybody hold my hand yet. I hope I don't when I'm 65. But do you think that, does the federal law provide any extra assurances for anyone because of, say, advanced age? I'd ask Mr. Grover if you know of any.
Yeah, it's called Social Security, I think.
Thank you. This is Perry Grover. No, it doesn't. The federal law doesn't distinguish its protections on the basis of age. It leaves it up to the an older individual, anyone for that matter, can go to the U.S. Department of Labor and file a claim and have it processed at no cost to themselves. And the same is true in Alaska. Anyone, regardless of age, can go to the Alaska Department of Labor and have their claim processed. And I'm not saying this facetiously, but in 13, 14 years of dealing with the Alaska Department of Labor, I found them to be generally reasonable and very professional, and by no means pushovers. So I think that the concern that Mr. Roop raised is really a matter of educating his members that if they feel they've been cheated out of money they're owed, go to your local Alaska Department of Labor office and we'll be taken care of.
So then, Mr. Grover, is there anything in the revision, in the revised law, that makes it more difficult for, say, an elderly person to receive the equal treatment?
Nothing whatsoever.
Mr. Weirich, would you respond to that?
Well, it doesn't distinguish among categories. I mean, it deals with workers.
And does existing law?
Existing law? Under the Civil Rights Act would prevents discrimination.
But they will still have that protection, will
they
not?
Yes, they would.
So there's nothing diminished. I guess what I'm trying to find out if we've diminished any protective rights that senior citizens might have by the new draft.
By this draft?
Yes.
By the draft? No.
By either.
You diminish by the bill, you diminish rights. Because it prevents them, I mean, it diminishes the clout they have over an employer paying them what they're owed.
But that's the same as everybody.
That's right. I mean, that's the same as everyone.
Exactly. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulder.
I think that Mr. Grover's point smack on the nose, that senior citizens aren't asking to be treated special. They're not asking to be treated differently. At least I hope they aren't. They're employees just like everybody else. But DOL is prepared and capable of handling these problems, and they handle it on a regular basis. If you feel you've been cheated, talk to DOL. And they routinely handle these things without the additional burden or cost through the courts of attorneys or the burden on the courts.
Representative Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, I see, in relation to what Representative Porter was saying, I see the Department of Labor has added a wage and hour investigator position in the governor's budget that we have before us, and those are the people who do these things. Whether it's related to this bill or what, but last year, Mr. Chairman, we had to worry about hanging on to those guys, those wage and hour investigators, and I'm glad we did, and I'm glad we're adding one.
Yes, I don't see that in the fiscal note we have here pertaining to this bill, so it's apparently for other reasons that the department might administer this.
They're the ones who do it, though.
Mm-hmm. So, is there anyone here from the department? Well, at this stage, then, we've got the department's recommendation. I think we've spoken to the department's concern to define good faith to include affirmative action, and I think we've at least been told by the testimony here that it's pretty much described already by case law, I presume, at any rate, in the federal level, and perhaps not needed. The inclusion of Section 4, what does the committee feel? Is there any? That was another point that the department brought out. We're not making special interest legislation, Representative Mulder. Well, do we have any idea as to what implication this might have?
Mr. Chairman, frankly, Section 4 with subsection C pertains to actions which may have arisen during this, if we would enact this bill, would affect those people who have begun litigation or who have made claims during that window of time between the time of pre-Kinshue and when this would be enacted. So it's the notch. It addresses the notch. And to address it being a level playing field. And I'm certainly willing to go with the feel of the committee, the will of the committee. Special interests, no, but it is arbitrary whether you want to go back and change the rules of the game for those people who have begun a process.
Representative Porter.
As opposed to most retroactive kinds of considerations, which I don't necessarily go along with, this one I do for the reason that what we're trying to overcome, I think, by this bill is the inability that exists under the court decision to do any negotiations at all. That's why they're in court, because they can't, because the law now says you can't do any negotiations. You could, but we're saying you can't. There's nothing to negotiate, yeah. So in effect, you can't. What we would be doing is allowing those cases that have been filed but haven't been settled the option, not the direction, but the option of trying to sit down and settle, and maybe we can save the court some time. I think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we've heard all the testimony on the bill. We don't have anybody else listed to testify. And there's no one else here that wants to testify. The chair would like to know what the wishes of the committee are.
I'd like to move the bill with individual recommendations. That's come up.
Representative Green?
Did we dispose of a yes. Did we dispose of the proposed amendment?
That's what I'm asking. No, the amendments have been proposed by and it's up to this committee as to whether or not anybody wants to.
If we vote for this motion, we will.
The two amendments.
The two amendments.
The amendments have not.
They have not been.
They've not been offered.
Okay.
They've been offered, but not by anybody on the committee here. So, the motion then is to move the bill as written, in current form, with the fiscal note out with individual recommendations. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved out of this committee with individual recommendations for zero fiscal note. We'll now move over to House Bill 403. This bill, incidentally, has two more committees, including yours, Representative Porter. You'll hear this one again.
Yes, I will. And I hopefully I can the same way.
And if not, you'll surely tell us why, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Grover.
Yes, thank you for taking my testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Next, we're going to take up House Bill 403, the uninsured, underinsured motorist bill that we've heard here the other day. And for the committee's to jog your memory, you'll recall we brought it up and we had a brief review by Mr. Jaeger, and then following that we had a relatively long input by Senator Donnelly, and with that for sort of footing here,
boy,
we've asked I mean, it absolutely threw me because I didn't understand it, and I thought the committee needed to have a better review of it. So at this time we're going to ask Howard Jaeger, if you'd come up first, please, and ask him to come back. And what I had asked him and others to do is if they would take the testimony and help the committee understand what what Senator Donnelly had told us. Never mind. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr.
Howard,
Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Howard Jaeger, and I'm with Shattuck and Grumman Insurance here in Juneau, and here today representing the Alaska Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. And I won't try and go through all of the things that these others have. I see that you've been given, and I suspect everybody's got them, from Mr. Combs and other, Linda Hall, our president, and also another synopsis of things that to try and get everybody up to speed, I guess, on this item here a little bit more. We think it's an important issue, and we talked a bit the last time about competition. And it's just a piece of the pie as far as we're concerned, but it's something that has to be taken care of and needs to be taken care of for competition to come in. As is pointed out in one of the letters, there are companies that come into the state, and because they write either youthful operators or impaired drivers or whatever, they, and by that I mean people with drive speeding tickets and all that kind of thing, they may be only want to offer the state required limits of liability, or maybe they'll go up to $300,000 and that, but according to the law, as it's currently written, they must then go further and offer the $1 million, $2 million uninsured underinsured motorist limits. And quite frankly, it's something that very, very few people in Alaska are buying. They, I think you have testimony in there from one large agency that has one on their books, as far as they know, with the million limits. In our agency, it looks like we have about two on our books. And one of them is an attorney, and another, I don't know what the other one is, but it's one of them was a fellow that had followed the original law as it came along, and as soon as it went into effect, he came in and bought the coverage. And, you know, he must have a good reason to do that. We think there's better ways to do it as far as buying, having a good major medical policy to protect your whole family and so on, not just from the uninsured driver. The way we're asking that this law be changed is that the people that want the higher limits would still be able to buy them if they want to buy higher liability limits. And what we're saying is that if it makes sense for me to buy $300,000 of liability insurance to protect the other fellow that I may run into, then it only makes sense that I would be able to buy the $300,000 to protect myself from the other guy that hits me and doesn't have any insurance. Why would I want to buy a million on myself? I can't fathom it anyway, buying a million coverage on myself to protect myself from the uninsured driver when that's only one of thousands of things that could happen to me and my family in this day and age. Another thing I think that we may want to note, and that is that Alaska currently has the highest mandatory auto insurance limits of any state in the union, including all 49 states. We are more than double many, many states in our mandatory insurance requirement. You add to that the cost of uninsured motorist, and the price to the consumer goes up. One of the reasons for mandatory auto insurance was to try and get more members of the public insured. And, you know, it was an admirable thing to do, I believe, but when we have the high limits and then we come along with a mandatory offering of high uninsured motorist limits, it's having a real impact on cost. We're seeing a lot of youthful drivers that don't want to buy uninsured motorists, so they're not buying it, period. They aren't even buying the minimum limits because, according to the law, they can opt to not. It's an option. They don't have to buy it at all, so they're not buying it at all. The cost is a big issue. I see it going up, 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 because we have seen uninsured motorist premiums that they're charging the public going up, up, up for the last 2 or 3 years, and I'm sure that's because it's coming right back around to haunt us now on this uninsured driver, underinsured driver issue. A lot of what we've seen is in the property damage, but the bodily injury would go right along with that. An interesting note I wanted to make to you was that the highest level of activity we've had as feedback from customers has been about a year ago, when a gentleman named Charles Gibbons was in town putting on a seminar on how to make money, save money, you know, how to be a millionaire overnight, so to speak. And his dissertation to the people, and we had a couple of people from our office that attended that, was to go back the very next day, call your insurance agent, and cancel your uninsured motorist coverage because it's a waste of money, blah, blah, blah. You should buy major medical insurance and things like that. That sparked a high level of activity in our office from people calling and saying, hey, I want to cancel this coverage off. And we try to explain it to them. And in fact, several people did take that coverage off of their policies. We don't like to see that, but, you know, they're the boss. They have the golden rule. They have the gold, so they make the rules. So they have to come in and sign an option to take that off of their policy. This is a bill that does have support from the Division of Insurance. I don't know if you have that in writing or exactly where, but they see the situation as something that needs to be taken care of apparently as well. We think it will help with more competition. I can't tell you, I wish I could specifically tell you that there's a company or two that said, yes, if this is changed, we'll come to Alaska. But like I say, it's a piece of the pie. It's a part of what we need to do to make sure that we have competition. We've seen recently what happens here in town with competition if you're going to go to the service station and fill your car up with gas. And we think that this is something that, you know, we need to have in the back of our minds and and be very much aware of. I believe that finishes me up for today. I hope I didn't get too...
Thank you, Howard. No, that's good. I think we'll ask John George, who's assigned to testify, to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here today representing the National Association of Independent Insurers, a trade association of property casualty insurance companies. And they like it to be known that they're sort of the offbeat companies, not necessarily the ones you think of, but started out with State Farm, someone who was using controlled agents, Allstate, someone who was selling insurance at the counter at a Sears store, USAA, who specialized in writing, military officers, sort of offbeat, but they're also specialty companies that have niche markets. They write crop insurance, and they write motorcycles and things that sometimes the mainstream insurance industry is not prepared to deal with. I can testify as the former director of insurance that when Representative Donnelly, then Representative, now Senator Donnelly, got the law changed, that we did lose several insurance companies who were riding in Alaska, very small pieces of business, but motorcycles, some military business type companies, because they just didn't have the reinsurance. They had reinsurance to write low levels of coverage, but they didn't have reinsurance that would protect them for $1 million or $2 million uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage, and it was not economically feasible for them to go out and rearrange their entire reinsurance program to write a few policies in Alaska. They could write under the reinsurance that they had for all the other states, but to change it to write a few extra policies in Alaska, it just wasn't worth their time, their trouble, and they adiosed, which meant that those people generally had to go to the assigned risk plan because there were no voluntary markets that wanted to write that particular niche. So not only did those people lose a good, viable market, then they had the stigma of being in the assigned risk plan, and the insurance cost more there to boot. My clients feel very strongly that coverage ought to be offered under sort of the golden rule theory: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you buy high limits to protect them, then you ought to be able to make sure that you get in reciprocity the same limit as if they had bought the coverage. The other thing that this type of coverage might do, and that's create a moral hazard. For instance, motorcycles are often involved in one vehicle accidents where there's no contact with another vehicle. They may say, well, I was forced off the road, they didn't see me, and I hit the telephone pole and I'm really banged up. Well, could happen, but we suspect that in many cases they're phantom vehicles. Well, geez, if you could buy $2 million uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage to protect yourself when you run off the road, you might think about as a motorcycle driver that that's a much better deal than if you're driving a pickup truck. And I think that there was some of that kind of problem, and one reason we lost the motorcycle markets when this bill was introduced.
So you do support the bill?
We support the bill, but we do want to make a point that we believe we should offer the limits of liability for uninsured motorists that people buy for third-party liability, and that would happen under this bill. So, yes, we do support it.
Any questions either Mr. Yeager or Mr. George? All right. Those are the only, thank you very much, John. Those are the only two people who have signed up to testify on this bill. It's the chair's interest of moving this bill out of this committee, and the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move remove HB 403 out of committee with individual recommendations.
And fiscal notes.
And I
felt fiscal notes.
Don't see any.
I've got two zeros. And commerce and admin.
Probably Linda thought you probably had to memorize the zeros.
Commerce and admin. In any event.
All right.
With the 2-0 fiscal notes that I don't have.
All right. We have heard the motion. Any objections to moving the bill out
either,
with
so
individual recommendations with
one.
Zero, two fiscal zero,
one
zero
computer.
Fiscal notes? Any objection? Hearing none. Move. Okay.
There
that completes our work today.
Well, yeah,
the committee to be sure and sign the bill movement. Thank you for being here. So we'll carry over the Dalton Highway turnoffs until the next time we meet, along with the other bills that got ahead of us there. We're on that dock.
This just turning off or opening up?
I don't know. When I drove up there, I wanted more turnoffs, I'll tell you that. Why, when you're going up that Attigan Pass and you see those big trucks coming down, oh, remember that, Joe?
Yeah.
We looked at the thing and I said, now, wait a minute, you know, where are we going to go?
Did you ever drive the old highway, hard highway down?
You got, I mean, there's a problem.
Oh, they're just trying to tell me.
For the meeting. All right. Thank you.
It's 4:13 and this is...